Some time ago, the headlines were filled with the story of a new Supreme Court nominee who was asked a very difficult question in the hearing leading up to her nomination, and that is, what is a woman? What is a woman? Remember that? Very difficult question, right? And she could not define what a woman is. I think all of us know deep down inside she sort of knew. But for political reasons, she knew if she would answer it a certain way, there would be ramifications, and there's a group of people who are politically active, who are not living in reality, and so they want to define things differently, and she was going along with that. What is a woman? I think most of us know that and understand and are really reeling a little bit in our society today because of the lack of an understanding of reality and how our society is changing. And it seems like it's happening faster and faster, and it almost takes your breath away every time something new happens. And a big part of how it's happening is that these radicals are redefining reality. An obvious question is, when did it start? And we can think of certain watershed moments in our history that really started to tip the scales. Perhaps it's a few years ago. I think it was 2015 when the Supreme Court ruled that to define marriage as only between a man and a woman was unconstitutional, was incorrect. So they redefined it, redefined reality. That redefined right and wrong. But maybe it goes back even a little further than that. Maybe to Roe versus Wade. Was that 1972, I believe? Roe v. Wade. When the decision was made that you can redefine murder, and then you can say that actually killing your unborn child in your womb is not murder, it's just abortion. Maybe that was when this started. Or maybe not. Maybe it was in the 1960s. Maybe it was in the time of Woodstock and the hippies and the slogan, "Make love, not war." Maybe that's when things started to be redefined, right? The meaning of love, not talking about love between a man and a wife, but certainly a sort of a immoral redefinition of anything goes. Maybe that's what it was. No, that wasn't the beginning, because Mr. Armstrong was talking during those years about referring to the 1920s. Remember? Remember the Roaring Twenties? I don't think any of us probably can remember the Roaring Twenties. But if you remember your history, he talked about the new morality, Mr. Armstrong did. And there is a book that came out in 1929 by author Durant Drake entitled The New Morality. But his description of morality was anything but morality. It was really immorality, and it wasn't new. Because you can pick any time in our history, and you will see people redefining reality and redefining sin. How about going back to a fellow named Constantine, who became a Christian and made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire? But he wasn't a Christian. He was an idol worshiper. In fact, the coins that were minted had his picture representing Sol Invictus, the invincible sun. And he wasn't a Christian, but they redefined the word Christian. And that has ripple effects to this day, doesn't it? Thousands, millions of people who feel they are Christian, but really they have no idea what it means to worship Christ. What does this have to do with today? Simple. One of the lessons that we learn during this Feast of Unleavened Bread is we are to come out of sin, but you can't come out of sin unless you first define sin. You can't come out of sin unless you first know what sin is. If you want a title for the sermon this morning, God defines what sin is. God defines what sin is. Leviticus 23 and verse 4, we read a little bit about this day that we are observing, all these days, the last 7 days. Leviticus 23 and verse 4, these are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at their appointed times. On the 14th day of the first month of twilight, at twilight, is the Lord's Passover. And of course, we kept the Passover last week. On the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. To the Lord, 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. Verse 8, and the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it. So that's why we're here. This is the seventh day, and this is what we're doing. Let's turn over to Exodus 13 and verse 3, because we need to ask ourselves, why are we observing this day? And what's the meaning of it? We understand it occurred when the children of Israel left Egypt. And was there any instruction given about the meaning of these days that were happening around that same time? Well, there were. There was. Exodus 13 and verse 3. Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. Verse 6, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. That's what we're observing today. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days. No leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. And you shall tell your son in that day. There's a reason, there's an explanation. And this goes way beyond just that generation, because none of us were there, right? This has been hundreds and thousands of years since this happened, and yet there's still instruction about what happened and why it happened and how it applies to us. You shall tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. It shall be a sign to you on your hand and a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. Therefore you shall keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. So we are eating unleavened bread. God told Moses, said, you shall tell your sons, this is why you're eating unleavened bread, and daughters, and explain it to them, explain the meaning that you're coming out of Egypt. And for those who then come later and have no historical background in coming out of Egypt, there's something they're coming out of, and that's spiritual Egypt. They're coming out of sin. But what is sin? That's the big question. And that's the world around us is getting more and more confused about. How far back does the redefining go? Well, spoiler alert, go back to Genesis chapter 2. It goes all the way back to the beginning, doesn't it? There is no point in history, our history, this nation's history, Western culture's history, the history of the world. There is no point in history that you can say this is the time when sin was started to be redefined, except for the very beginning. The very beginning. When God created mankind, put him in the garden, and this is what happened. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 15, "Then the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, 'Of every tree of the garden you may freely eat. But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in that day, the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die.'" And Mr. Armstrong explained many years ago and many times that what essentially was happening here. God was saying that, look, it's not just a matter of this is the tree of life and this is the tree of evil. He was saying this tree over here is a combination of good and evil. And in a sense, you, if you take of that tree, you are taking to yourself the prerogative to decide good and evil. And we know the story. That's exactly what they did. That's exactly what Eve did. And then she gave to her husband, and he ate with her. And that's been the story ever since. God laid out the rules. He set the standard, made it very clear. But we as humans, going back to Adam and Eve, we want to set the rules ourselves. And yet God defines what sin is. God defines what sin is. And as God called people out of the world, from Moses to David or Samuel or the apostles, this is one of the first things he would establish. He said, you have to understand that I define what sin is. It's not your imagination. It's not culture. It's not morality or majority rule. It's not just what everyone thinks. And isn't that what the starting point is for us at baptism? An understanding that there is someone who created us, and therefore he makes the rules. Notice in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 4. So how does God define sin then? If it is his prerogative to define it, how does he define sin? And this is a big deal. If we're keeping these days and coming out of sin, what is sin? Because our culture is extremely confused on this. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 4, in the King James Version, I'll read. It says, "Whosoever commits sin transgresseth also the law, for sin is the transgression of the law." Now, I know this isn't rocket science or a surprise to all of you. This is very familiar. But think about the ramifications of this whole world going off and going astray because of not understanding this one very simple point. Sin is defined by the transgression of God's law. So let's talk a little bit about some definitions. Let's lay out some definitions from God's word of what sin is by understanding what the law is. I'll just refer to it. Romans chapter 7 and verse 7, Paul said, "Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law. For I would have not known covetousness unless the law had said, 'You shall not covet.'" So, what are some definitions we can lay out from God's word of righteousness and sin? Number one, God defines love as the fulfillment of the law. God defines love as the fulfillment of the law. Let's turn over to Romans 13. Romans 13 and verse 10. We'll just read part of this whole section here. But verse 10, "Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law." So there you have it. We could close our Bibles and have the sermon be done now, right? Because that really is the sum total of the law as defined by God. It's not complicated. It's the basis of every law. It's the way God thinks. And we could leave it there, but you and I both know that the world gets this mixed up because the word love has been redefined, hasn't it? As we were talking about a moment ago. If you walk down the street and you ask people on the street, is it good to love others? How many are going to say no? 99% are going to say, yeah, we should love each other. Everybody should love everybody. But what does love mean? That's the question, isn't it? So let's go to our next definition, number two. Love is broken down to love towards God and love towards neighbor. Notice Matthew chapter 22. Matthew chapter 22. Thankfully, God breaks it down so we don't have to be confused about what these words mean. Let's let him define it. Number two, love is broken down to love towards God and love towards neighbor. Matthew 22 and verse 34. When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. Then one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him and saying, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" And Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." So a profound example here about how God says love is the overarching principle, but then I'm going to divide it up into two general areas. Love God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength, and love your neighbor as well. But there's still a problem, isn't there? Because you can talk to a lot of people who say, oh yeah, I love God, I love the Lord, and they have no idea what it means to love God. You can talk to those same people on the street, do you love your neighbor? Absolutely, we should love everybody. And they still have no clue what the Bible says. In fact, there was a website I ran across some time ago recently detailing some of the facts concerning the homosexual lifestyle and the lower life expectancy, the health issues, problems, greater rates of suicide that are all related to the homosexual lifestyle, which the media downplays. The government and business corporate leaders who are pushing this, they downplay these things. But it's there. But the website left comments open, and of course there were many, many opinions, and oftentimes the comments to these things are more interesting than the actual articles. And there was a quote from a lady defending homosexuality. I'm assuming she's a lady. Catherine Rose, December 14th, 2022. And this is what she said. "Being a homosexual teenager myself, I find it completely ridiculous that people are trying to find ways to label being homosexual as dirty and negative. If straight women can find men attractive, then why can't queer men love other men? We're not living in the 1800s. If people want to love their own gender, why can't they? The Bible was written during a time where being homosexual would get you killed, and Jesus didn't write the Bible." Now, there are a whole lot of things wrong in this, her dissertation here. Layers of misunderstanding. And because certainly Jesus Christ did inspire, in fact, every word of the Bible. But she says, so how can we know what he is truly thinking? Well, we can know what he's truly thinking. The whole Bible is what he's thinking. Jesus could have been gay or bisexual. Now, hold on a second. No, he couldn't have, because he did not sin. And that's what means he is our perfect Passover sacrifice. And he defines sin, so no, he couldn't have. Jesus could have been, I'm reading what she says, not what I think. Jesus could have been gay or bisexual. Would you love him any less? He did all those miracles. Does being gay change that and automatically make him a bad person? Now it's sort of assumed that he was. You see where this goes? I think not. Gay people have feelings too. Don't make it hard for them to come out. Love thy neighbor. I know that I do, regardless of their beliefs. So she's quoting the Bible. Love thy neighbor. And yet, no understanding at all what those three words mean. Because they've been redefined. And because we as people and humanity has not allowed God to define what sin is. God defines what sin is. So let's go to another definition. Let's break it down even further, because obviously there's a lot of confusion out there on what love is toward God and love is toward neighbor. So number three, our third definition, the Ten Commandments define four ways to love God and six ways to love neighbor. Number three, the Ten Commandments define four ways to love God and six ways to love our neighbor. Let's turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 5. Deuteronomy chapter 5. This is the restatement of the Ten Commandments that were originally there in Exodus 20. Let's read what he says. Deuteronomy chapter 5. We won't focus on every single one of them, but let's read this through. Deuteronomy 5 and verse 5. It says, he said, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. That's the first one. Love God with all your strength and heart and mind and soul. Just like Christ said. Verse 8, you shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments. So he says he doesn't want images of him. He doesn't even want aids of worship of him, because he knows that eventually those will be objects of worship. And he says, don't worship me that way. This is defining how to love God. Verse 11, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Honor God's name. And yet you know how many euphemisms there are that sweeten it a little bit, but really still are taking God's name in vain, belittling it, using it in ways that are not appropriate for the character, the power that is associated with God's name, not using it in such a casual and careless way. Going on, verse 12, observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy. As the Lord your God commanded you, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your ox, nor your donkey, nor any of your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. And remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Now, this is interesting because In the Exodus 20 version, it doesn't bring this out. But in the Deuteronomy 5 version, he's connecting the Sabbath with coming out of Egypt. Remember, you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. So we are to remember coming out of Egypt. We are to think about coming out of sin during the days of unleavened bread, but we also are to remember it on a weekly basis as we keep the Sabbath. The Sabbath is a time that we are to be reminded of this journey that we are on. So those four define what it means to love God. What about the last six? Let's turn to verse 16. Honor your father and your mother as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be long and that may be well with you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. So now we get to the first one of loving your neighbor. What's interesting is this commandment is actually a little bit of a crossover. It is teaching how to love our neighbor, but we understand that when we as children learn to love our parents, we're actually learning and modeling eventually how to look to God too, aren't we? So really this, in a sense, this one is a little bit geared toward both loving neighbor as well as loving God. Verse 17, you shall not murder. How can we justify killing, what is it now, over 60 million unborn babies in the womb? But we call it abortion. We call it something different. We redefine it so it doesn't sound like sin. They are tissue. They're not babies. It's abortion. It's not murder. It's just redefining, but sin is still sin, isn't it? Verse 18, you shall not commit adultery. You know, how many in our Western nations want to uphold traditional values and conservative values and standards until it applies to their private life, until it applies to their personal life, until it applies to when they want a new husband or new wife because, well, they don't love that one anymore. You know, in a 2015 survey, the question was asked, it is, I think this is by Pew Research, is it a sin to live with a romantic partner outside marriage? 36% said yes, it is a sin. 40% said no, it is not a sin. And the assumption is the leftovers, those 100% minus 76% said they don't know. They're not sure. How much redefining of sin has been going on for a long, long time. We also know that actually the Ten Commandments are not the only laws because the statutes elaborate even further. And speaking of this in terms of sexual sin and committing adultery, Leviticus 20 and verse 13 says, if a man lies with a male as he lies with a woman, both have committed an abomination. It is a sin. And yet, in another survey of just last year, 71% of Americans surveyed thought that gay or lesbian relations are morally acceptable. It's clear that we have no anchor as a people, don't we? And yet, when did it start? Not in 1972, not in 2015, not in the 60s, not in 1929. It started at the very, very beginning. Going on, verse 19, you shall not steal. Verse 20, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Verse 21, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not desire your neighbor's house, his field, his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his neighbor, his ox, his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. So these Ten Commandments, form a basic law of dealing fairly and lovingly with your neighbor as well as loving God. So very, very helpful. And we've talked about this all the time at the feast and on the Sabbath and different times. What a different world it would be if even the letter of the law were kept. If even one of these Ten Commandments were kept by everyone in the Western world today and around the world, what a different world it would be. They form the basis of righteousness because they define what righteousness is and therefore define what sin is. Now, we could be done with the sermon right now and walk away feeling pretty good if we didn't murder anyone this past week. Hopefully none of you did. If we didn't steal anything, we didn't commit adultery, we didn't bow down to an idol, and we could feel pretty good. We don't have really think anything to come out of because we're keeping the letter of the law. Now, if we are breaking any of these letter of the laws, then we need to deal with that, don't we? And we need to repent. And we need to ask God to apply the sacrifice of Christ. And we need to change and overcome. But even if we're not breaking the letter, we're not off the hook, are we? That's a terrible mental picture, off the hook. I wouldn't want to be on the hook. Whatever. In other words, there's one more definition we have to talk about. And that's number 4. God defines the thought of the sin can be sin itself. God defines the thought of the sin can be sin in itself. Now, I've saved the largest part of the sermon for this section. Because I'm assuming that most of us in this room are keeping basically the letter of the law. I hope that's a good assumption. I think that's a good assumption. But it's really number 4 that gets us more often than not. Now, please understand when we say the thought of the sin can be sin itself, I don't mean the thought of stealing. If the thought of stealing something flashes across your mind that you've already sinned, that is not what that means. Jesus was tempted in all points and yet without sin. That means the thought of a sin came into his mind. The point is he did not nurture it. He didn't hold on to it. He didn't let it roll around in his mind. He didn't feed it. He didn't ponder it. He didn't think, oh yeah, that would be nice. Well, as long as I don't get caught, I can just think about it. No, he didn't do that. Matthew 5, verse 21. Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder,' and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment." That was, we just read in the Ten Commandments. But he said, "But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in the danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, 'Raca,' shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be in danger of hell fire." Now, maybe we didn't murder anyone in the last year. I hope not. But have we had a moment of anger or even hatred? Have we allowed that to flourish? Have we allowed that to burst open? Did we nurture hard feelings? Did we say things that we ought not? Did we fill our minds with acts of violence from TV or movies or video games? This is a huge element that we have to face, isn't it? When we understand that God defines what sin is. Yes, the first step is don't break the letter of the law, that's sin, but the next step is don't even harbor or meditate or allow to root thoughts of hate. God knows that If we stew on something long enough, if we let it sit there in our mind long enough, eventually, given the right circumstances, we would be capable of murder. That's why that's a sin. And when we each come to baptism, that's one of the profound things that in stages that we have to reach as we are thinking about baptism, that maybe we've never, you know, robbed banks or stolen cars or murdered people, but when we really see ourselves, we understand, given the right circumstance, given enough time, given the right temptation, and if I allow myself to ponder it and let it sit in there and take root, I am capable of anything. That's really when we understand why we need Christ's sacrifice. Matthew 5, verse 27, notice, here's another example that Christ said, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell." You know, I think this speaks to the current epidemic of pornography that is destroying relationships all over the Western world. Because not having an understanding of what happens when this takes place. And you know, the media, entertainment, they make fun of it. They laugh at it. They think it's normal. It's not normal. It's a sin. And it will destroy people. Brethren, as we look at our lives over the last year, as we examine ourselves, as we have examined ourselves, as even we look at our life over the last week, let's see how far we've come. Let's see what we need to grow in, letter of the law, but also spirit of the law. Notice in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 3. 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 3. Where is this going? What is the point? What is the goal? It's not just keeping the letter, but actually it's much, much higher standard. 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 3. "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thought that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ." Wow. That's the ultimate way we should let God define sin, that we run every thought through the filter and say, is this a thought of godliness, or is it one of greed and pride or lust or vanity, or selfishness? And we know that we've been eating unleavened bread this past week. What a powerful mental picture, and what a powerful physical representation of what we are talking about. Notice over in John chapter 6, John chapter 6, every time that we picked up a piece of unleavened bread, it wasn't just going through some ritual. It wasn't just because that's the letter of the law. That is what God says to do, so we do it. But there's a reason for it. John 6, 56. Jesus said, "He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him." That bread, we're not just, you know, pinning the bread on our coat. We're not just putting the bread in our pocket. We're not just piling it on our head. We're actually ingesting it. so that it becomes part of us. And it's symbolizing Christ coming, becoming part of us. As the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so he who feeds on me will live because of me. This is the bread which came down from heaven, not as your fathers ate the manna and are dead. He who eats this bread will live forever. What a powerful picture that has been over the last 7 days, and I hope it's been fulfilling for you, that thinking about that bread and thinking about my walk with Christ and thinking about, you know, it's not just keeping the letter of the law. It's actually ingesting the law, but ingesting Christ, who is the embodiment of the law, so we can think like him. There's actually an interesting relation to our day-to-day, I think, in Revelation chapter 12. When we think about the time we're living in, let's turn over there, Revelation chapter 12. This is the passage where it talks about the church being protected in the wilderness. We won't read the whole part. But you know what it says, how the woman is the church, and she's given two wings of a great eagle. She flies to the wilderness. She's nourished there. The serpent attempts to go after her, but the earth helps the woman. God protects the woman. And then the dragon is enraged, verse 17, with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring. Now notice this, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. You know, we could be keeping the commandments of God in the letter faithfully, doing everything right with the Ten Commandments in the letter, outwardly. And we could still find ourselves in a very, very difficult spot in relation to this passage in the future. Is keeping the commandments in the letter the only thing that we should strive for? Well, let's turn over to Revelation chapter 3 and talk a little bit about Philadelphia and Laodicea. Remember the Philadelphian era that is protected? The Philadelphian era in chapter 3 and verse 10, Christ says, because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. But then in verse 14, he speaks to the Laodicean church. He speaks to the last era. And what does he say? Verse 14, to the angel of the church of the Laodiceans write, these things says the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. I know your works, that you are neither cold nor hot. I could wish you were cold or hot. So then because you are lukewarm, neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth. Because you say, I am rich, have become wealthy, and have need of nothing, and do not know you are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire, that you may be rich, and white garments, that you may be clothed. Now, what is this talking about? You know, the name Laodicea means judgment of the people, or the people judge, or the people decide. That's the two Greek parts of the word together essentially mean that. And think about it in this light. You know, we're talking about our generation is coming to a point of redefining sin out there in the world. Well, we know what sin is in the church, don't we? It's breaking the Ten Commandments. And this group of people is God's church, the Laodicean church is God's church, so they will be keeping the commandments. What is it that God is saying is wrong? Could it be that they feel rich and increased with goods and self-satisfied because they do keep the commandments? And yet they haven't really surrendered their lives to God to take on, as he said, white garments that you may be clothed. What is God really looking for in righteousness? A change of heart, right? A change of our spirit. A change of our mind. A change of how we think beyond just keeping the commandments. You know, could we wind up falling into a position where, well, I'm keeping the commandments, but I will judge whether my heart is okay or not. I will decide whether the decisions I make are right or wrong. And if they're not breaking the commandments, they must be right. You know, Mr. Weston gave a sermon some years ago entitled something to the effect, "Is It Okay?" is the wrong question. If we're always looking for, you know, is this going to break a specific law of God? And if it's not, then I can do it. We might be keeping the commandments, but we might be missing the whole picture, brethren, about what God is trying to accomplish in his people in our time. And that is for us to understand the spirit of the law. Isn't it interesting? In Exodus 20, we read Deuteronomy 5 a little while ago, the last commandment is, "Thou shalt not covet." And a lot of people talk about the Ten Commandments are all about letter of the law. Have you ever noticed the tenth commandment is not about the letter of the law at all? It's about not coveting, which is something that goes on in the mind, isn't it? Now, we might see outward expressions of it. We might see the actions that relate to it, but really coveting is of the heart. And brethren, isn't that one that's particularly difficult in our day? Because of the affluence that we have in our day? Because of marketing constantly telling us that we need what we don't have? Even our technology is built on the whole premise of a continual cycle of coveting. Dopamine hits, right? Is this not one of the most difficult, perhaps, sins to fight against in our day? If we really examine ourselves and think about it and look at our lives. What about the first commandment? "You shall have no other gods before me." You know, as I get older, this one seems to take on more and more meaning to me, to understand it. You know, what really is the most important thing in my life? Do I make a god out of other things or activities or people? Not bow down to them, but what do I really spend my time thinking about? What really gets my attention? Am I constantly being distracted from what I need to do to a thousand other things? Not that we go through the whole day just praying all day long, you know, or just reading our Bible constantly all day long. We have to work and sleep and eat and all of that. But brethren, you know, is everything we do supporting that goal of loving God with all of our heart and all of our mind and all of our soul and all of our strength? If it's not, then we're sinning, because God defines what sin is. And that is a hard standard to attain to, isn't it? Now, maybe in the last 7 days, we've seen our own ugly human nature in ourselves. I have, in myself. I have. How can that be? I just kept the Passover a week ago. And, you know, we are considered sinless at that moment. So how can it possibly be that I could have any human nature over the last 7 days? Well, just like how yesterday I was home, spent some time at home, and had an idea I'd take one of our daughters out for lunch. So I was telling my wife, I think we'll go to Firehouse Sub. I've recently come into the understanding of Firehouse Subs, and they're really, really good. And I'd recently been introduced to them. So I think we'll go to Firehouse Subs. She said, "You don't want to go to Firehouse Subs. It's the days of unleavened bread." Oh, woo! Of course! It was just a few days ago that we kept the first day, and we've been eating unleavened bread every day, and yet I still forgot, and I thought, let's go to Firehouse Subs. Brethren, if you saw sin in yourself in the last week, don't despair. The whole point is God is bringing us out of sin. Be thankful that God is showing you. It doesn't mean you just continue in it. You know, just like once my wife reminded me, don't go to Firehouse Subs. And I would have thought, well, it's too late now. I'm going. And then, you know, eat it anyway because I had the thought. So I've already, no. I didn't go. Just so you all know, understand. So if we see sin in ourselves, we don't despair. We're still coming out of Egypt, aren't we? We're still growing. We're still letting God and asking God to change us. And it's a process. But we have to keep going. That's the point. And we have to let God define sin. Luke 17 and verse 5. Notice Luke 17 and verse 5. Here is a story or a parable that I think has puzzled me sometimes. What exactly does this mean? Luke 17 and verse 5. Actually, verse 7. Jesus said, "Which of you, having a servant plowing or tending sheep, will say to him when he has come in from the field, 'Come at once and sit down to eat'? But will he not rather say to him, 'Prepare something for my supper, and gird yourself and serve me till I have eaten and drunk, and afterward you will eat and drink'? Does he thank that servant because he did the things that were commanded him? I think not. So likewise you, when you have done all things which are commanded," maybe we can write in there in the margin, you don't have to really write this in the margin, but we can think, when you have done all things that were in the Ten Commandments, right? Letter of the law. "Then say, 'We are unprofitable servants. We have done what was our duty to do.'" What is Christ saying there? He's saying, "I want your heart. I want your motivations. I want you to change how you think, not just what you outwardly do. I want you to let me redefine sin in your brain, not just by what you do with your hand." And if we ask him, he will do that. Our heart is tricky. Our heart is deceitful. Our heart is difficult to deal with. And that's why we need God's help. You know, there's a quote that I got from a college textbook of my wife years ago when she was in college. She took a philosophy class, and I've got a lot of really good material from that over the years, from that philosophy class. There was one textbook that was entitled, "Who's to Say?" Who's to Say? And it was a conversation among several people about life, about values, morals, what's right and wrong. And one of them quoted Herodotus. And this is what Herodotus said thousands of years ago. "Everyone without exception believes his own native customs. and the religion he would be brought up in to be the best. There is abundant evidence that this is the universal feeling about the ancient customs of one's country. One might recall in particular an anecdote of Darius when he was king of Persia. He summoned the Greeks who happened to be present at his court and asked them what they would take to eat the dead bodies of their fathers. Now, I'm sorry for that mental image, but this is what he said, so bear with me. They replied that they would not do it for any money in the world. Later, in the presence of the Greeks and through an interpreter so they could understand what was said, he asked some Indians of the tribe called Kalate, who do in fact eat the parents' dead bodies, what they would take to burn them. They uttered a cry of horror and forbade him to mention such a dreadful thing. One can see by this what custom can do. And then the writer in the book, who's to say, custom is king over all, and Herodotus already saw it clearly a couple of thousand years ago. Brethren, you know, that seems ridiculous and outrageous and disgusting to us, thinking about that and just how ridiculous that premise is. But as each day goes by, I think we can see that our culture today is doing things that are more disgusting and more ridiculous and more crazy and more outlandish than we could have ever imagined. How blessed we are that we have been called to know the truth, that we are keeping these days, that we have been given an understanding of a redefinition of sin, an understanding of the original definition of sin. And these days are part and parcel with understanding and letting that sink in so that we can come out of it. Let's turn over to 1 John chapter 3. In verse 16. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 16. John writes, "By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us." You know, all the crazy definitions of love, which aren't love at all, it's just an excuse for human beings to do what they want. But God is love. Christ is love. And so therefore, he even gave his life for all of us, including those people out there who are misinterpreting what love is. Right now, they will know someday. He says, we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. Verse 18, my little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. And by this we know that we are of the truth and shall assure our hearts before him. For if our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart and knows all things. Yes, even if we have seen sin in the last 7 days, we must not despair. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence toward God. And whatever we ask, we receive from him because we keep his commandments. Notice this. It doesn't end there. Because we keep his commandments and do those things that are pleasing in his sight. As we have been keeping these days, and as we are observing this last final day of unleavened bread, let's be thankful for these days. Let's understand the anchor point that it gives us, the stake in the ground that it gives us, an understanding that the world does not have and has not had for 6,000 years, and that's why it's all going crazy. The premise is wrong, but we've been given a different premise. And it's not just keeping the letter of the law, that's the basic minimum. It's learning what pleases God so we think like him, accepting His will, asking for His will, asking Him to show us His will, and then responding to it. Let's embrace the opportunity that we have, brethren, to go forward and continue to learn exactly what it means to live by every word of God in the letter and in the spirit. During these days of unleavened bread, let's thank Him, let's be thankful, and as we go forward, that He has opened our eyes to see. Let's continue to change and grow, because we know that these 7 days are not the end. It's something that is symbolic of us in our whole lifetime. Let's grow, let's change, let's overcome sin, but let's always remember the first step to do that is to deeply understand and accept God defines what sin is.